This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Well, I wound up working in prison in a pretty roundabout way, which I'm sure is true of many people who work there. I did a dual program in graduate school in social work and in the School of Law. In law school, I had the opportunity to work with a family law clinic, and we would travel as a group to maximum security prisons and deliver workshops on the legal rights of incarcerated parents. And though I was there under the auspices of the law school, I'm in my heart a social worker, and I was really intrigued as an emerging social worker about prison, and it seemed to be really where a lot of social problems came to rest. And I returned to Oregon after completing a graduate program, and a friend told me about a job they'd seen posted to start a new program at the women's prison at Coffee Creek, and I was hired to do that about 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. So it's been about 10 years that this program has been in effect?
It has. It was a different program in its inception. It was a federally funded family literacy program, and it was a phenomenal program. But in looking at the families that we worked with, it was clear that they needed more than outcomes related to passing GED subtests and for the kids' alphabet awareness and basic life skills. So in 2010, we lost our federal funding, and knowing that the program had become a lifeline of sorts for our families, and knowing that despite all odds, we consistently met and exceeded our outcomes, we had to fight. So we marched down to the Capitol with alumni of the program and caregiver alumni and a video and some data that had been done on the program indicating it was working. And with the aid and advocacy of a key state senator, the Department of Corrections committed to keeping the program. And it was at that time that we became the Family Preservation Project and designed the program that we truly needed to have. It was a program that would honor the paths that led many women to prison and honor the fact that when a woman goes to prison, the family system goes into crisis.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, why did the federal government cease funding that program? It seems like it kind of pays for itself when we look at how much it costs to incarcerate a person and how the families are affected and how the families are, you know, the resources that a family takes seems to amount to much more.
So we were the first and then the only program, family literacy program, that was housed in a prison. And it was a major effort to try to fit this very sort of strict, stringent model into the confines of a prison. And despite that, we were very successful as a program, but federally the money was drying up. And in the state, there were once 19 or 18 programs, and then at the time we lost our funding, they were down to just a handful.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Is it true that I was kind of doing some research in the Oregon Department of Correction reports children of inmates are 5 to 6 times more likely to end up in jail themselves? Is that pretty much accurate?
Well, that was definitely the prevalent lore when this program started, and there was actually very little literature about this phenomenon of children and incarcerated parents. We know now that that's not true. That you're statistically not more likely to go to prison because your parent was in prison. The circumstances within a family that lead one to go to prison are the circumstances that put these kids at risk: poverty, addiction, neglect that results from that. And those circumstances are what pits kids at risk. But mm-hmm. The very virtue of their parent being incarcerated does not place them at any greater risk. However, mm-hmm. What happens to a family when a mom goes away is pretty dramatic, and a lot of things fall apart, and that's where we believe that we can come in and make a difference.
You know, it's so touching when you see women and their children interact behind bars. How many women give birth behind bars? Is that a substantial number?
It is a substantial number. I mean, in our program alone, I would say at any given time, about 30% of the women have given birth in prison.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What are some of the things that continue to motivate you when you see these kinds of situations, when you see the interaction and things of that nature with this particular program and the women inmates involved in this program?
Well, I mean, I think what really intrigues me is the idea that we really don't live in isolation. Children in particular don't live in isolation. They live in relation. So looking at what really happens when we remove someone from society, when we remove someone's sister, their brother, their wife, their husband, their mother, their father, somebody's child, there's so much loss and so much that happens systemically. Mm-hmm. Kids move households, they move schools, so much ground stands to be lost for these kids who have committed no crime. And, you know, after all this time, I don't hold any great answers to our current practice of mass incarceration. I mean, I know that there are people diligently working on this, but in our small way, we're really addressing the problem that's before us or the set of problems and trying to develop interventions to improve the outcomes.
Mm-hmm. If this program is so successful, how come it isn't emulated? How come it isn't duplicated, I should say, at other prisons and maybe even in other states? I know that in this state, I think the family preservation program that you are involved in or that you founded is the only one in the state.
Yep, that's correct. I mean, I think, you know, it takes a long time to hit your stride, and I think we're in the place now where there is a strong possibility that the program hopefully can be replicated. There's some interest, Portland State University, on looking at, you know, the 10 years worth of data that we have on the program and, you know, helping position us to be in a place where we can maybe assist in replicating this program in other prisons or other states.
Mm-hmm. We know that when we talk about the disparities, when we talk about the overrepresentation of African Americans, particularly when it comes to our numbers, the ratio of our numbers with those of us who are arrested, and the amount of African Americans arrested, is your program, what's the percentage of the family preservation program in terms of ethnicity? Of those women that are involved?
Well, I think in general, the demographic of Coffee Creek sort of represents the demographic of the state of Oregon, kind of from a racial percentage perspective. Our program, you know, I think it's been a goal and a mission of our program to represent sort of the most underrepresented individuals, and so. You know, as a component and mission of our program, we really strive to have some racial diversity, ethnic diversity in our program. So I would say about, 50% of the women in our program in a given time are women of color.
50%?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, okay. All right. What else? We talked about, I'm aware of your efforts to try to break the cycle when it comes to women who are incarcerated and the effects they have on their children and recidivism and so forth. What are some of the tools that you give women in order to try to cope with the situation?
I think ultimately we're supporting them in parenting from prison, and sometimes that means really parenting for the first time. You know, some women were very active with their kids, and some women say it's really the first time they've ever been with their kids in any sort of meaningful way. You know, I think there are two things that happen when women become incarcerated. They either distance themselves to numb the pain, and they hope for the best when they release. And this is really often no fault of their own. There just aren't enough programs to support families and assist in parenting from prison. The women in our program try to continue to parent and make phone calls to their kids every week and write letters and visit at every opportunity. And as a result, they're really confronted daily with their guilt and their shame and the profound loss. You know, all the little losses, missing mm-hmm. first day of kindergarten, not being able to tuck them in at night, mm-hmm. Not being able to pick them up when they fall. They reassure them over the phone. They virtually kiss them, give them lots of love, and snuggles when they see them, and it's perhaps weeks later when the wound is healed and the memory has really been erased. But they have that opportunity. They have 3 hours to spend with their kids outside of the visiting room. They can take their shoes off. They can have their kids sit on their laps. They can snuggle. They can read stories. They can do those things which seem small, mm-hmm. But they're big. They have the opportunity to participate in parent-teacher conferences. They get report cards. They have opportunities to sit down with caregivers of their kids and really talk about co-parenting and how they're going to survive this experience. And we have the opportunity to support the kids with after-school programs, with tutoring, with support around mental health, with summer camps, with the things that will really help to to give them a focus and some strengths. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Are there any plans or are there any instances where the fathers are brought into this kind of situation or the fathers are involved in any way in the in the program or in the communication with the program? I mean, we call it the Family Preservation Program. Mm-hmm. So
certainly, you know, we also have fathers who are incarcerated, and we facilitate phone calls from facility to facility so that the parents can talk about parenting matters and the welfare of their children. If the father is actively parenting, we have a caregiver group that the father can come to and receive some support. He can also participate in the meetings with the families. And, you know, if we have a father who's a single parent supporting the child, we are able to help with covering the cost of preschool and extracurricular activities and, you know, having the mom actively parent as much as she can from prison so that the burden isn't just on him alone.
Well, do they transport them for the mail over to your facility, or do you just deal with phone calls and letters and things of that nature? Or?
Yeah, when their two parents are incarcerated, the contact is telephonic only.
Okay, okay. You're listening to It Takes a Village. I'm Shahid, and with me today is Jessica Katz. She's the founder and principal director of the Family Preservation Program for incarcerated women in Coffee Creek Women's Prison. And she's here with us today, and we certainly want to thank you. Jessica, does this interaction, having the child connect with the mother and the mother connect, pardon me, with the child, does that help lessen the behavior or affect the behavior of the inmate while she's doing time?
It does. I mean, I think it has, I think it has a tremendous impact also on the behavior of the children and on the moms. It really just gives them a focus. It gives them grounding. It gives them a reason to endure what they really endure there on a daily basis, because their goal is to go out and their goal is to parent their children, and they're not waiting to do that. They're actively doing that. While they're incarcerated, they have the opportunities to do that. So, you know, many of them say, you know, without this program, I would give up, and I just wouldn't do what I'm doing. It really gives me the motivation to put one foot in front of the other.
Mm-hmm. I could imagine that the need is greater than the resource that you provide. How does a woman get involved with this particular program? Because I know probably you only serve a small percentage of those women who do have families and children and so forth, and are able to access your program.
Yeah, we serve probably 1% of the overall population. I think collectively, the programs that serve children there serve about 10%. So, with most things there, the need really exceeds the ability to provide services. And we know that, and we're sort of in the throes right now of enrolling new women in the program, and it's definitely the hardest part of my job, because I really have yet to meet somebody that couldn't benefit from the services and isn't worthy of the services. We have made some efforts to reach beyond serving just the women in our program. We've created a family resource center at the prison that's staffed by mothers in our program to reach out to women who really just have lost contact with their kids, who don't know where they attend school, who maybe don't know who they're living with, to try to, you know, in some small way, put some of those pieces back together. We've also developed a speakers bureau. So on a monthly basis, we have community partners come in and reach in, and that is open to every woman who's interested in receiving any information or assistance. We have, you know, between 30 and 70 women attend each of those sessions.
You mentioned community partners, and we have a couple of radio programs here on KBOO that are deeply involved with the inmate, the whole area of incarceration. We have a program entitled Prison Pipeline, but we also, I have a cousin of mine, JJ. He does Sunday morning gospel music, and he wants to go down and set up some Bible study classes and things of that nature. He's trying to do that. Would that be something that the community partners would partner with community situations, can that, how would that work?
Well, doing anything in prison isn't easy. I will say that, but there are certainly avenues to to bring people in, particularly people involved in the faith-based communities, or there's a chaplain at the prison, and that would sort of be the best avenue, I think, to bring those sort of programs in.
What other community partners do you have? I know you read something about you have other programs as well. I'm not sure if they are emulating what you're doing, but certainly making a contribution in that area. Head Start, I believe you have an early Head Start program, and Girl Scouts or Boy Scout program or something of that nature.
Yeah, there's an early Head Start program on the premise of Coffee Creek that serves women with children up to the age of 3. There's a Boy Scouts program, and there's also a Girl Scouts Beyond Bars program. There's also a Parenting Inside Out program.
Do y'all work together or kind of overlap at any point?
We do. All of the women in our program attend the Parenting Inside Out program. And in terms of the other programs, because so few women are served at Coffee Creek around parenting, we seek out women who aren't involved in other programs, particularly, just so that we're spreading the resources as widely as we can.
I want to get back to the tools that you give women that can help break the cycle of children maybe being affected or being incarcerated, as well as the parents or following the parents into that lifestyle and things of that nature. So what are some of the tools that you try to give the female inmates to alleviate any possibility of the cycle, the cyclical nature of incarceration between women and children?
Well, certainly, one of the things that we do is we really advocate for the women to get all of the services that are available to them at Coffee Creek that may help them, with particular issues that led them there, whether it's drug and alcohol treatment or cognitive treatment, mental health support, work-based stuff if they've never worked before. So we serve as advocates for them to get into every program that they can that may assist them. In my experience, Coffee Creek's not full of women who didn't love their children enough not to make the choices that they did. They really made the choices they did because they didn't see a better choice in front of them. Mm-hmm. And so we're, in examining how you want to be as a parent, you really begin to examine who you want to be as a woman, who you want to be as a person, who you want to be as a member of your community. So we work with women over a long period of time. It's not a quick turnaround. We'll sometimes work with women up to 3 years, and we get to know them, and we get to know who they are, and we get to know their children, we get to know their families. I think that's the part that really works. There's a relationship, and that's often really frowned upon, within the confines of a prison, because a lot of time that word has a bad connotation when you're talking about having a relationship in prison. But in the context of what we're doing, I think I find that that's what really works. We meet with these women every week, and we help them through their struggle to want to grow and to want to change, and help pick them up when they fall and be there on the other side. Mm-hmm. We have an alumni association that we created so that we had a mechanism for following women outside of the prison. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's like you're blindfolded and throwing darts at a dartboard. You just don't know what sticks. You don't know what's working. Mm-hmm. So we meet once a year with women, and some of them keep coming back, and they've been out of prison for 8 or 9 years. And, we collect some information from them about what are you struggling with? What did we do that helped you? And so it's unique. We have the flexibility to really redesign our program every year based on what we find out from our participants.
Following, how much follow-up do you have in terms of, I know, again, resources are sort of meager to some extent. How much follow-up can you have? You mentioned the alumni. You have an alumni situation where, and I would imagine some women can't come back to say what they ran into on the streets. When they come back out here, we still got mental health issues. We still have lack of resources, lack of jobs, is there still a recidivism issue? How do you handle that?
When we find out that things aren't working?
Well, you know, is there any follow-up, basically, I guess is what I'm saying. Is there any follow-up once a person is released?
Yeah, certainly. You know, the contact.
And assistance given them once they'll hit the street so that they won't be forced to go back and make some of those bad choices that you talked about.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, women definitely keep in touch with us, and they hopefully call before, you know, things get to a place that, you know, they make a mistake they can't recover from, and you know, and we can guide, and we can assist, and we can advocate, and we certainly do all of those things, and it's difficult because they leave a very high level of support. It's a funny place in prison that you find support, yeah. But the women in our program truly do, and then they leave, and you know, a lot of that safety net really goes away, and you know, things do fall apart.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And are there any ways to assist to reinforce some of the things that you talked about while they were in prison?
Yeah, and really truly connecting with the Alumni Association. You know, sometimes these women, they come back and they see each other and they connect and they talk and they share resources and they share information and what they've learned along the way. And, you know, they inspire each other to keep moving forward and to remain focused. And it's pretty powerful. It renews us for the year to come, for sure.
Well, you ought to be congratulated for founding this program, first of all, and then sticking with it for the amount of time that you have on such a issue that is so basic to human society in terms of the family. And I certainly want to thank you for taking time out of your schedule to come up from Coffee Creek to be with us today. The Oregon Department of Corrections appears to be in support. Where could you get more support? You know, we know that we have Lou Frederick, politician from our district, there, Chip Shields. What are some of the things that our listeners can possibly do to assist you or to make your job just maybe a little bit easier in terms of funding and things of that nature?
That's a good question. Yeah. I mean, we're always looking for money, and you know, more to the point, I think we're really looking to humanize people's stories, and so if anybody has the opportunity to volunteer or to come meet these women, I think as long as they remain other, and that's what I think the criminal justice system is good at doing. You know, mm-hmm. The women are sort of taken away and
dehumanized.
They're dehumanized, and you know, they are placed on a very nondescript exit off a freeway, and nobody really has to think about them again. And I think that's what really compels me, to sort of give a voice to people whose voice has been taken away. And, you know, I think the more awareness, the more people talk about this issue, the more people come together to look for perhaps better solutions, you know, the better we'll all be for it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Real quickly, we only got about a couple of minutes left, but during that 10 years, are there any kind of stories that stood out for you, any kind of experiences that stood out for you, any kind of successes that you've seen that, again, motivates you to keep doing what you're doing? Anything right off the top of your head that you could share with our audience?
Yeah, I mean, I think the greatest victories we have are when we see the criminal justice system and the child welfare system kind of collide, and the you know, advocacy that we can do within that system to really change the outcome. So we have women in our program who were you know, supposed to lose their kids, lose the right to have their kids, and lose the right to be a parent. And at our alumni association, and, you know, we have the fortune of seeing women who have beat that system, and who have who were never supposed to have the right to parent their children again, you have them in their custody, have them in their care. I think that's a true victory, and there, you know, there are a number of those stories.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How often do the kids come down? How often is a mother given her child or able to work with her child in your program?
So physical contact, 2 times a month for 3 hours, children come in and they visit with their moms and share a meal together and have the opportunity to play outside and play baseball and, you know, throw a football around and read stories together on each other's laps. And outside of that, they're able to parent by using telephone and by writing letters through the programs, really promote as much contact as they can have with their kids.
And thank you so much. Jessica Katz, founder of the Family Preservation Program at Coffee Creek Women's Prison, here today on It Takes a Village. Thank you so much. I'm Shahid Hamid. Until the first Friday of next month, ciao. We'll see you, okay? We're out. Peace.
KBOO Evening News provides breaking news about local issues, from water fluoridation to immigration raids. We bring you daily coverage of what's going on in Portland, Cascadia, and around the world. Tune in every weekday at 5 for the KBOO Evening News on KBOO, your community radio station.
PDX Fusion creates events that celebrate different modalities of expression and community building. Friday, March 1st, KBOO Radio is proud to help PDX Fusion in sponsoring a night themed around dreams at The Refuge, 116 Southeast Yamhill. The night begins with a lecture entitled The Art of Dreaming, which will include visual representations of dream theory, demonstrate practical work in our relationships, as well as give the audience a brief opportunity to explore inner work. That's Fusion Dreams at 116 Southeast Yamhill. This is a 21 and over event on Friday, March 1st at 8 p.m. More information can be found at kbu.fm/dreams2013.
Women are murdered by abusive partners every day. Kathleen Blankenship shot her abusive husband, who was also an ex-cop. She was sentenced to life in prison. She will tell you how she broke through the wall of blue and had her murder conviction overturned. Hear her story on Prison Pipeline, March 4th at 6:30 p.m.
Talk about your revolution. It's Independence Day. Let freedom ring. Let the white dove sing.
Roger Pete is an artist and a printmaker whose work tends to focus on the contemporary crisis of biodiversity and what can and can't be done about it. In 2012, he spent 3 months in the Democratic Republic of Congo. In preparation, he created silk-screened bandanas with detailed pen and ink drawings of protected species found in the future site of Lomami National Park. The new Lomami National Park in eastern Congo is a unique and exciting project driven by the efforts of U.S. scientists John and Therese Hart and their Congolese colleagues in a region known as TL2, after the initials of the three rivers that run through it. While many parks and preserves in poor countries are established by decree, they and the people who live in eastern Congo are doing something different by making the local people part of the process. They are negotiating to set aside a large tract of forest for a new national park. You can hear more about this project on Tuesday, March 5th at 8 p.m. at the Waypost in Portland. I spoke with Roger in February 2013.
Congo was the first country in Africa to be granted independence from its colonial masters, and that happened in 1965. And the first independent, free, you know, independent president of Congo was Patrice Lumumba, who was a more or less a nationalist politician who said some pretty critical things about the Belgians as they were leaving, which made a lot of people, specifically people who had a lot of monetary interest in the country, very unhappy. And to make a long story short, the U.S. and Belgian interests got very closely involved in Congo and essentially had Patrice Lumumba assassinated and installed in his place his secretary, Mobutu, Joseph Désiré Mobutu, as president. And he ruled the country for the next 30 years. And he ruled it with a similar sort of iron fist, but with a particularly kind of venal authority that ended up destroying a lot of the infrastructure and that the Belgians had built in the country and setting the stage for the sort of enormous corruption that exists there right now. The aftermath of the war was a really largely brutalized society.